sometimes behave so strangely.
Hello and welcome to an episode of the So Strangely podcast, the podcast on recent research in music science. Today we're going to get into a new area, something we haven't talked about before, and that is music education. And with me to get into music education stuff is Ethan Hine from New York University. Hi, Ethan.
Hi, Ben.
So we're going to be talking about a form of research that is a bit different from a lot of the stuff we've talked about before. This is a very interesting essay that draws from case studies as well as a lot of theoretical work to discuss racism, to discuss whiteness in music education. It's a fascinating piece by Juliet Hess at Michigan University. The name of the paper is Equity and Music Education, Euphemisms, Terminal Naivety, and Whiteness. Ethan, how did you come across this article?
So I'm working on a dissertation in music education, and it's about hip-hop in music education, or the lack thereof. Mm. Given that music technology makes it possible to produce, you know, great-sounding original music, even at a pretty beginner level, without spending a lot of money, you would think that music teachers would be eager to embrace this method of teaching, and they so far haven't. Mm-hmm. A lot of that has to do with the way that music educators themselves are taught, which is mostly within the Western art music tradition. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of emphasis placed on things like rhythm, timbre, kind of non-standard voice qualities, all the things that you associate with hip hop and other kind of contemporary popular styles.
And that exclusion isn't an accident. What Julia's paper gets into is the history of music education in North America, or mostly America. You know, how a Eurocentric view of music privileges this type of music as being superior and kind of advanced compared to other forms of music, compared to Black music heard in America in the 19th century and indigenous forms of music and music from other cultures around the world, and how that is twisted, a view of what music is important. And then also touches on a number of factors that shape who gets to study music, what music is studied, how music is studied in this professionalized context of, you know, conservatories and post-secondary education. And then she draws from how this can be challenged, this practice and view of music can be challenged in music classes and music appreciation classes in elementary school through a bunch of case studies that she performed for her own dissertation. She draws from good examples of music teachers using music to interact critically with systemic racism and systemic white supremacy, and takes that into questions of how we can continue to address this and redress these wrongs in the context of post-secondary education. There's all kinds of interesting implications that I think are very important for music research more generally. And so I'm really looking forward to this conversation, how this can help us as a larger academic community study music more consciously and challenge the ways in which we perpetuate these problems.
Yeah, like we tend to think of racism and white supremacy as qualities of individuals. Mm-hmm. You know, the point of critical race theory in general and Juliet's work in particular is to say that, no, it's not necessary for an individual educator or researcher to harbor any kind of ill will or bias at all. We're working within institutions that were themselves shaped in a time when it was common to have overtly white supremacist views. Mm-hmm. And so if you're just kind of passive and conflict averse, you're unwittingly perpetuating these ideologies from, you know, 100 years ago. And so even if you personally are not racist at all, and even, you know, sort of think of yourself as anti-racist, which I think most music educators in this day and age probably do, you may still inadvertently be perpetuating white supremacy without realizing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so she talks about this as the terminal naivety, which is a term developed by another researcher in this area, where by focusing, for example, on, you know, this idea of individual progress and meritocracy, we can get into the habit of thinking about the success and failures of students, of musicians, as being solely due to their own work, when that is not the case. And it's easy for people that are in a privileged position to be ignorant of the systemic processes that they are perpetuating. And so these kinds of conversations are really important for us to learn how to challenge that.
And also, I mean, just defining like what success and failure even are in music.
Yes. This idea of, you know, what counts as musical competence, what form of musical behaviors are rewarded. To be able to play well what is on a page in front of you is only a small part of all the things that can count as proficient musical behavior. As a dyslexic musician, it's been a constant frustration that what I do musically is sort of undermined by this expectation for me to play what's on the page. You know, I'm not very good at playing what's on the page. I'm sorry. But that doesn't mean I'm incompetent musically. And I mean, and that's my own particular frustration, but there's many other ways in which our structures of defining musical success are excluding all kinds of very important aspects of music. And that focus towards a specific musical culture is so exclusionary and very frustrating, and I think very limiting in terms of how we even come to understand what music is. Before we get too far into this, I just want to get a sense of what this kind of work is, whether, you know, her research project is kind of consistent with how music education research is done. So as I understand it, this is a paper that works with specific theories that are existent in this sort of arena of social sciences, and then brings that point of view to case studies, to working on, you know, these experiences that she had embedding in classrooms where she recorded her impressions and she recorded specific events that she saw, you know, teachers preparing lessons and performing lessons and navigating interactions with their students, interviewing teachers, and then from that drawing on this material to inform how these theories and these systems are expressed and navigated in the context of music education. Are case studies then the standard source or common source of, I guess, like, a, you know, empirical observation for music education?
Yeah, I mean, education research is pretty much always qualitative just because it's really difficult to operationalize it. It's very difficult to disentangle cause and effect. It's difficult to even quantify what it is that you're measuring. I guess if you're talking about learning, you know, music theory, you can look at people's test scores, but aside from, you know, very specific factual knowledge like that, if you're assessing how effectively people are learning music, you're in this qualitative kind of realm just by necessity. There have been a few quantitative studies of the field of music education looking at demographics, for example, really just in the past 5 or 10 years, though. I mean, it's a pretty new field. Music education research is not new, but most of the research has been about methods, like what is the most effective way to get your wind band to play in tune or whatever. So this more kind of sociological bent is, it's relatively new. It's kind of a small and emerging corner of the field, but I think a really important one. And, you know, and all of these things about critical race theory and such, this is all like 101 level stuff in sociology of education, but in music education specifically, it's quite new.
Yeah, I feel like that's the case for a lot of music stuff. There's like things that exist in other disciplines, and then we think, oh yeah, we should really get that in here too. And so we're taking baby steps. All right, I think Juliet is ready to come in here and talk about how she did this work. Are you ready for that, Ethan?
Sure.
Okay, let's do this. And now joining us on the line is Dr. Juliet Hess, Assistant Professor of Music Education at Michigan State University. Juliet, thank you so much for coming on and talking about your piece.
Absolutely. It's good to be here.
First off, I know that you have a long history with this topic, racism, systemic racism, and confronting whiteness. So how did you get into this area of research within music education?
Well, music education, unfortunately, is a very, very white field, and there have been multiple research studies done on the pervasiveness of whiteness in music education. So I think the issues of race and racism are pretty pervasive. And as a field, we have a lot of work to do. So that's where I'm choosing to live at the moment. And I would like to think that there will be some kind of resolution, but this is one of those things where you write an article and it's published 4 years later and all the things you said were still relevant.
Yeah.
So it's pretty depressing.
Do you mind addressing your position on this as a white person coming to this, or your background? How do you relate to themes of racism?
Well, I think that as a white person, I can work on whiteness. I think whiteness as a dominant ideology is pervasive, and that is a major issue to address. I feel in some ways I'm less able to work on racism in particular, but whiteness is a major problem mm-hmm. in the way that systems operate. And as a white person, I feel like part of my responsibility is aiming to dismantle the way that white supremacy operates and the field that I happen to be in is music education. So that's my focus.
So coming to a project that looks critically and uses specifically critical race theory to address systemic whiteness within the field of music education, you're working with many different sources of information. You're working with historical analysis, you're working with case studies, you're working with obviously your own experience and observation of culture more broadly. How do you go about building an analysis of what you see as the systemic issue?
I mean, I think the way that I started with this is looking at the systems that are operating and then thinking about how they manifest in different places in music education. So how does racism operate, for example, in K-12 schooling? How does it operate in pre-service teacher education? How does it operate in our scholarship? How can we point at mm-hmm. the different places in music education and look at the ways that race and racism manifest and the way that whiteness operates? And I think that a lot of my research focuses on, well, who's doing anti-racist work well mm-hmm. and what can we learn from them? So much of the research in this particular piece is rooted in both my own experience and this article focuses on my doctoral work, which is a multiple case study.
Mm-hmm. One of the big challenges in dealing with this stuff is that we talk about it sort of at one level of like, yes, we recognize there are these systemic racism, but then we still have to deal with the specifics, the nitty gritties. And your case studies bring to light interesting instances of talking about how race can be addressed within the context of music education. So how did you approach the process of, you know, choosing to study these specific instances, these teachers, these classes? What were the case studies like for you?
Well, it actually started a little bit more simply than perhaps whatever impression the article gives, because I was a music teacher trying to do social justice work. I was teaching public school, usually grades 2 to 8 or so in the northern Toronto area. And I was trying to figure out how other teachers who were interested in social justice work were doing that work in their classrooms. Mm-hmm. I was a practicing teacher, but I didn't have a car, which meant I couldn't access any of the professional development that was local. Mm-hmm. And I felt pretty isolated as a teacher. So when I went to do my doctorate, I basically made my own professional development. I sought out through a recruitment call teachers who felt that they were doing, I mean, I used words like anti-racism, I used words like multiculturalism, mm-hmm. the kinds of words that are coded for trying to do social justice work in music education, ironically, because this article is about not using coded language. Yeah. But I found 4 teachers who felt that they were really enacting this work in their classrooms. And I went to sit in their classrooms for 8 weeks at a time. Wow. And it was a fantastic experience. I mean, I think any teacher should have that kind of opportunity to make their own professional development and really kind of push their own teaching and their own work in the direction that they see as important. So I spent a lot of time with these 4 teachers and, you know, looked at student behavior. I wasn't specifically working with students. My research and my ethics review were to work with the teachers mm-hmm. and conducted a number of interviews throughout the process. And the later interviews were perhaps more informative because it allowed me to zoom in on particular moments that I had observed and really think about what the kinds of things that were happening in the classroom and the ways that the teachers perceived, mm-hmm. you know, events that occurred. So we could get pretty specific mm-hmm. because things emerge in classrooms constantly, as we all know.
Mm-hmm. In your paper, you detail a discussion about the history of Black music in the U.S. as an outcome of the system of slavery and the Middle Passage. And we hear people talk about this all the time with all of the euphemisms.
Right.
Talk about, you know, this echoing down of African rhythms and various kinds of music. But what you seem to emphasize in the article is not just that there was an acknowledgement of a history of African influence in, let's say, popular music today, but that this was a vehicle to actually name the systems that were operating, that you know, to say this is what happened to Black people in the U.S. at this time, what it is, what slavery is, and then how music was a part of the cultural survival, the effort of survival in that context.
I mean, I think one of the most remarkable things is that, you know, there was one teacher in the study who addressed it specifically. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you wonder when you're teaching third grade, like, can I be explicit about colonialism? Can I be explicit about slavery?
Yeah.
She was explicit about both. Like, and she used language that was really child friendly to make these things deeply felt. Like, there were so many moments in her classroom where it was just silent as students were absorbing mm-hmm. what the information was. But at the same time, there were opportunities to really think about the strengths of different peoples as and the resulting music, and to kind of lean on that side while also looking at oppression in serious ways with very young children was remarkable. I think the other piece of that, as we look at whiteness in music education, is the ways that particular skills are valued and other skills are devalued.
Mm-hmm.
Notation reading and Western classical music and, you know, the dead white men who are, you know, often posters on the walls in music classrooms are typically valued in music education. But I think all of these teachers made choices about valuing different skills and different music. So improvisation, I mean, I have no idea why that wouldn't be valued, but it is certainly not one of the skills that is typically valued in classical music.
Mm.
But we have choices as teachers to value skills associated with different musics, and that we don't have to continue to toe the line that replicates the same system over and over again.
It's interesting that improvisation used to be one of the cornerstones of classical music education.
Sure.
Mozart and Bach and all of these people were famous in their lifetimes as improvisers. And it was really only with the advent of jazz that improvisation came to be coded as like a Black thing. So yeah, the exclusion of improvisation from formal music education is a relatively recent development.
Interesting.
Hopefully one that we can reverse.
Yeah.
So, Ethan, can you describe your approach to music education in a context where you aren't trying to recreate these same systems that have been so commonly perpetuated in how we teach music in schools?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a pop music guy. Mm-hmm. And so, like, you know, the class that I teach at, in the NYU Music Ed programs, the Music Technology Practicum, that's an intrinsically racialized conversation because, especially since the rock era, like, Black music and pop music have been pretty much coextensive in the United States, right? It's just impossible to talk about rap or techno or funk or disco or even rock for that matter without getting into racial issues.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't. So, OK, if you come from rock like I do, there is a canon in rock, but it's a very different canon. And like the blues is at the heart of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you are taught to think, yeah, well, the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin and all of that stuff, that's derivative. And the real stuff is Chuck Berry and Muddy Waters and Robert Johnson and Etta James. And so it was very surprising for me to come into the music academy in my mid-30s and discover that that is not how everyone else is. So, you know, I will say, like, music education has worked really hard on, quote, diversity, unquote, and in the past few decades on the repertoire level. Every chorus sings the South African song, Siyahamba.
Mm-hmm.
I just went to this music ed conference at UConn, and the first thing we did was we all sang Siyahamba. But they almost never talk about, like, apartheid. Like, it's an anti-apartheid protest song. But while many, many school kids out there are singing the song, nobody's talking about apartheid.
Yeah, I remember my own, you know, youth choir days. That was a big popular song for us, too. And the political context of it wasn't the discussion around the piece of music. When we touch on multiculturalism, Juliet, you were in Toronto, which is in Canada, and multiculturalism in Canada is slightly different than multiculturalism in the States. What is it a euphemism for in the Canadian context?
Well, I mean, as you noted, the history is different. And I mean, multiculturalism in Canada is rooted in the official policy of multiculturalism, which mm-hmm. kind of came in 1970. And similar problems in a lot of ways, but with a little bit of a different bent, because multiculturalism was theoretically celebrated, but not any deeper than superficially. So mm-hmm. I feel like in a lot of ways, the Canadian official policy of multiculturalism is fine with food festivals and fashion and mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily extend to any deeper cultural practices that we might engage with. In the U.S., it's a little bit different. You know, in that same time period, it was kind of the melting pot analogy. And assimilation was the goal in a lot of ways. Like the racism is, I mean, it's distinct, but it now operates, I think, fairly similarly. In some ways, the Canadian context is perhaps more complicated because it's under the veil of celebration. Mm-hmm. And you have to perhaps look a little bit deeper to recognize that there are limits to what we're willing to celebrate as a Canadian society. And that perhaps is more complicated than the less closeted racism that happens in the US.
It's really possible to celebrate something without particularly respecting it.
Yep.
The first university to bring a jazz musician in a sort of academic context rather than an entertainment context was NYU. They had Duke Ellington and the Duke Ellington Orchestra give a performance during a music lecture in 1932, which was amazing. But he was invited by Percy Grainger, who was a music professor here for a minute. But Percy Grainger was super white supremacist, outspoken. And his attitude about jazz was, oh, it's the pure, unfettered kind of primitive utterances of
sensible.
You know, they're like the birds, right? And he loved jazz, and he really admired Duke Ellington, and he thought that Western art music would benefit from this kind of directness and freeness, but yeah.
Percy Grainger has written some fantastic chamber music that, as a bassoonist, I've really enjoyed, but the baggage is substantial. This example brings up how strong a history there is to the way in which whiteness has been emphasized consciously or unconsciously, deliberately or accidentally within the conservatory, within post-secondary education. The idea of the primitive has been such a big part of the way in which the conservatory has treated and ignored musical practices outside of the kind of the Eurocentric vision of the great masters, the canonical masters of orchestral music. Can you give some more specifics to that, the aspects of that that can be addressed, that can be challenged, that can be broadened?
I think part of it is not settling for celebration, to know that there's always more and that you can go deeper, and that to not do a song like Siahamba, for example, without the context of it, and to be insistent on situating musics within their contexts and not pretending they're ahistorical. Mm-hmm. And I think if we take the approach that music is a human practice, we have a very different conversation than some of the multiculturalism and ways that we invite different groups perhaps to the table without actually meaning it.
This is a not trivial challenge, because if music education as a field has a dominant ideology, it is the ideology of no ideology. music teachers are anti-political. Let me put it this way. I went on the Music Educators Facebook group to ask if there was any research on the political preferences of music educators. Not to ask people on the group what their politics were, or just to ask whether research exists. And the group collectively flipped out. Panic. They thought, oh, you're just in here to persecute the MAGA people, and it's touchy. People think that there's no way to enter into these conversations without anger, recriminations. Yeah, it's delicate.
I totally agree with that, but at the same time, we know that there is no such thing as no ideology, and that we're all rooted politically, and that everything that we do in education is political. So that's a really nice way to put it. I think we're pretty invested in that idea. I think it actually connects to Lise Vaugeois's idea of terminal naivete, which I took up in the article. Like, music educators are pretty invested in kind of not that kind of hyper-political awareness. And that's rooted in the conservatory-like training. There's an interesting connection between no ideology and choosing to kind of remain disinterested. And classical music itself often pretends to, well, classical music doesn't pretend, but folks pretend that classical music is disinterested and it's a neutral music, where, of course, it's deeply situated and not neutral in the least.
Well, this brings to mind a very common idea that comes out of the way in which music was discussed at a theoretical level in the early 20th century, where it was treated as being kind of like deliberately meaningless, distinct, non-referential, and the idea of absolute music as being completely separate from culture, from language, from politics, from human realities, and in this sort of crystalline. And that way of thinking about music ignores what music generally is, which is culturally embedded and deeply defined by the historical context in which it's produced. Mm-hmm. It's a very frustrating thing to come from music theory and to see those ideas linger on. You know, the idea of music being universal, and that we can all, you know, understand each other just by the notes. Well, no, that ignores what music means, and it means a lot to people.
As you move closer to the popular music of the present, it gets to be harder and harder to ignore social context. My favorite example of what happens when you do ignore social context is a few years ago, Chris Tila, the mandolin player from Punch Brothers, he was hosting Prairie Home Companion, and he performed All Right by Kendrick Lamar and on his mandolin. And he's, you know, a white guy. And, ooh, it's terrible. It's online. It's worth surfing. Because it's musically not terrible. The guy is a virtuoso. He's probably the best mandolin player who's ever lived. And he nails the song. Like, his arrangement of it is kind of wonderful if you think of the song as just the sort of context-free work. Mm. But it's excruciating, you know, when you sort of think of it as a thing that exists in human culture.
The fluidity of music and how it allows us to pick up and play along and appropriate brings up all of these questions about the politics of music. And right now, actually, in Canada, there's a big excitement around Mi'kmaq translation of Paul McCartney's Blackbird.
Yeah, it's pretty beautiful.
It's gorgeous. It's powerful. It's really moved a lot of people. My mom was raving about it. I've been hearing about it everywhere. And one of the first reactions I heard was, you know, well, how does Paul McCartney feel about Indigenous peoples of Newfoundland singing his music when he's been vocal against sealing? And so there's these conflicts that arise when we mix cultures. And I don't know what Paul McCartney thinks. I don't even know if he's thought about that connection, whether that is even relevant to him. I hope it's something that he's comfortable looking past, because the musical performance is fantastic. And frankly, getting more people to hear Mi'kmaq is really important. So I hope this is something that is received well and respectfully. But there is a lot of ways in which we have to recognize that music is a clash of culture.
I think there's something important there as considering power and which direction.
Yes.
Cultural appropriation in music is so, like, I mean, it's so readily practiced.
Yep.
To bring it back to education, that's, I mean, what an excellent conversation to have in a classroom, because it allows you to consider all of the power dynamics and when things may or may not be appropriate. And that those are conversations I think we should be having with children as they consider and, you know, are sampling different things and what the implications of that are and where their positionalities in relation to what their musical practices are.
Mm-hmm. Myself, like, my attraction to hip hop as a tool for music education is not even about hip hop as a music, although, I mean, it's very important and very interesting, but more like as an ethos. And one of the key things in the hip hop ethos is keeping it real, right? That your music should be an expression of yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that in rap, covers are not a thing. You do not cover up people's songs. It's almost unheard of. Mm-hmm. Sampling, absolutely. Quoting, for sure. Doing a freestyle over someone else's instrumental all the time. But your words have to reflect yourself. And that is very far removed from the way that music education works, where all you're doing is talking about experiences that are not your own. Mm. And I do believe that it's valuable to sing songs that are remote to your own experience, but it's certainly worth questioning whether that's a skeleton key that unlocks every door.
Mm-hmm. Cheers to that.
That actually comes directly to what conservatory training is in, you know, the North American or in the Eurocentric, shall we say, music education systems and post-secondary education. People's capacity to recreate other people's music is how we evaluate each other. It's how we define success. And just by virtue of the canon that we are working with, that we are given from the beginning, that is hugely restrictive in terms of how we then, you know, what it is that we're allowed to perform. It's hard for me to think about how that example of systemic whiteness, how we can move away from that. Like, what does it mean for conservatory to branch out from that, to change the way in which we judge each other, to be able to support the development of virtuosity and skill when we have so much built around this very narrow idea of what the music is that we make?
There, I mean, there has been a kind of partial success story in jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, it went from being broadly condemned as not music at all to sort of grudgingly tolerated to, I wouldn't say it's like the core of the curriculum in most places, but at least it's like on the menu. And you can say, well, the embrace is kind of partial. They've embraced a version of jazz that leaves out a lot of what made the music special in the first place, namely, you know, dancing. And but at least it's in there, right? And the wind is certainly blowing in a more kind of inclusive direction. But it's definitely, you know, the challenge is to avoid this kind of tokenism diversity model rather than challenging like the basic goals and assumptions that like, okay, for your audition, you could do a Stevie Wonder song instead of like a regular classical piece. Like, that's not really what the goal should be, right? It really is more this question of like, are we going to move towards like personal authenticity and individual voice and things like improvisation, broaden the definition of what excellence is. I mean, Adam Cruz from the University of Illinois, after Kendrick Lamar won the Pulitzer Prize last year, posted on Facebook, hey, that's great. Kendrick Lamar won the Pulitzer Prize. Unfortunately, he would not be admitted to our music education program as an undergrad.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Juliet, as someone who is in a music education program, what tools are at your disposal to challenge some of this stuff? How do you engage in shifting the conversation and the way in which music educators go forward from here?
I don't even know that I have a good answer to that. Some of the difficulties with being in music education is studio teachers very much still control mm-hmm. admissions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a singer-songwriter who auditions for music education but cannot do a classical audition at the level that is expected, they are not admitted.
Mm-hmm.
We're in collaboration with studio teachers, and sometimes it's possible to get someone through. But I mean, we're kind of in a model of music education where the student can do both. And if they are a hip hop musician, but can also play French horn at a classical level, then the both and is absolutely fine. But we are not in an either or place right now. And I think that that would be something that we could be striving towards. Like, it would be fantastic if someone could show up at a music school to get a music degree with any musical practice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it raises other questions. If someone comes in and their instrument is tabla, could we hire a local tabla musician to do that kind of lesson teaching?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly these are conversations that come up. And I mean, we do have a committee here that is focused exactly on that. And I've been on it since its inception, but change in an institution is a glacial pace, unfortunately.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be something as esoteric as tabla, though. I mean, if you're talking about like rap, there's not exactly a shortage of practitioners.
Oh, true.
When I finish doing this, I'm going to go up to Harlem and go into this middle school where literally 100% of the kids can freestyle rap.
Yeah.
Some of, some of them are more enthusiastic than others, but 100% of them can do it. Some of the pushback I've got on, you know, my work is, given that the art form seems to be doing just fine outside of school,
why institutionalize it?
Yeah.
That's a fair question.
Yeah,
it is a good question.
You know, and my answer to that is it's not so much that hip hop needs to be institutionalized. It's more like the institution is impoverished by excluding it.
Yeah. And this is an aspect of it that touches on music science and music research and, you know, work into what music is. Music scientists often turn to the musicians that they have access to. It's an issue of proximity. Trying to study music in the context of a conservatory, your view is really limited to the stuff that's there. And I think there's a lot of questions we're not asking just by virtue of the fact that most of our colleagues can't freestyle rap. And does that make rap not music? Well, maybe to some people, yeah, but that's wrong. I will just say the muteness that Juliet, you talk of is perpetuated by the distance between what is there for study, for certain forms of study, because there aren't examples to change course, to give us a reason to change course.
Well, here and there now. I mean, there was a student who was admitted on their computer at UMKC. That was, I think, 2 or 3 years ago now. So, like, there are little glimmers. I was at a conference in Toronto for the American Educational Research Association, and there was someone presenting, I think, the University of Nevada. I might have that wrong, and they don't have an audition at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, there do seem to be little ripples of trying to make changes.
Yeah.
That will perhaps produce something different, but then who desires a music degree to begin with? And when a music degree has come to mean particular things.
Mm-hmm.
There is also a new backdoor, which is music tech.
Mm-hmm.
So the admissions requirements for music tech are quite different from all of the other ones, which is why I was accepted into the program.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it is kind of a safe haven for rock, pop, techno, hip hop people.
Yeah.
And as the demand for that grows, I mean, it'll have more of a voice. But yeah, it's early days.
It's an ongoing project. If someone's coming into the conversation without much experience with issues of the whiteness in music academia and music education, what is a good starting point?
I mean, I think so much of it is just noticing, right? You know, like, when you're in music education spaces, no matter what the level, like, look around and see who's in the room, who is participating, who is not participating, who is engaged. I mean, so much of whiteness is so easy to see in music education, but perhaps you have to be looking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we point, you know, our magnifying glass on any practice that is occurring, we will see racial dynamics. And just paying attention to that and thinking about ways that we might disrupt the pervasiveness is perhaps a beginning. I mean, there certainly is a significant body of research on race and racism in music education now.
Mm-hmm.
It is no longer a few lone voices. There are many folks doing work on race. And, you know, I think we can always have more. But I think so much of our power comes in, you know, we all bring different musical practices. We all bring different backgrounds to everything that we do. So when we are in music spaces, we have the ability to really look around and be critical.
Mm-hmm.
I want to recommend a specific book, which is Racism Without Racists, Racism and the Persistence of Racial Inequality in the United States by Eduardo Bonilla Silva. That book is important because it clearly separates the issue of systemic or institutional racism from individual racism. And you know, the sort of defensive reaction you get a lot of the time in this conversation is, well, I am not racist.
Right.
Yep.
Not the point.
And it was difficult for me to understand that this conversation is not about individual attitudes. But I think that book is probably the clearest and most cogent explanation of this idea.
Mm-hmm. So with this kind of experience and this point of view on music education and what kind of musics are, shall we say, facilitated institutionally and what kinds of musics are overlooked institutionally. Is this part of how you hear music in the everyday world? What role does this critical perspective play in our everyday experiences of music?
Certainly, once you have those glasses on, you can no longer take them off.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's a good thing in that it, you know, for me, like, I made a kind of self-conscious effort to go straight to the heart of all of the stuff that I had been taught to condemn. And it's not just formal music educators who do this. I mean, jazz musicians and rock musicians hate rap and techno too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so for me it was, oh, but some of the rap isn't so bad. Like the Roots, they play musical instruments. And so for me it was a challenge to say, yeah, okay, the Roots. And they're terrific and everyone should listen. But let's go straight to Lil Wayne. Like, let's go straight to the quote worst, unquote worst stuff and find out, why do people love this music so much?
Mm-hmm.
And now it's no longer an obligation for me. I learned to genuinely enjoy, you know, top 40 hip hop, and it can be done. So it is possible to educate your own tastes.
Mm-hmm.
Juliet, I read one of your more recent papers as well, where you talked about a class going to attend an orchestral music concert and the kinds of issues that raises. who are the players who created this music, and why is this the music that gets elevated into this position of supreme importance, you know?
That article was rooted in the fact that I was observing the same project in four classrooms of educators who were doing pretty explicitly anti-racist work. Mm-hmm. And three of the four schools chose to, you know, engage in that symphony concert. The Toronto Symphony Orchestra offers student concerts of the year, and it's not cheap. Mm-hmm. And the fact that three of four teachers still kind of thought this is something we should definitely do, it's an experience that's important. I think where it was different was the framing in all three of those schools that this is one music, this is one musical practice, this mm-hmm. is not the be-all and end-all. Mm-hmm. Here, have an experience. Mm-hmm. But it's very interesting how, you know, even in spaces that are anti-racist, it still comes to be privileged as an experience that one should have. Mm-hmm. And the policing around it is interesting because it's very sanctioned in a lot of ways by white women, mm-hmm. which is, you know, historically true as well. That's an interesting and complex challenge for us. Like, what might it mean to instead take the money that one was going to invest in the symphony concert and go to a benefit concert? And perhaps it's complicated in schools to decide money is going to go in a particular direction, but mm-hmm. I feel like it would be a really profound experience to know that your money was contributing to a particular cause instead of, you know, something that is so institutionalized at this point.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if these schools also put similar resources into giving students experiences with virtuosic musicians of different genres and different traditions. Like, what would it mean for those students to go to a concert that gave them maybe a chance to dance as well, or to see...
Participate, what?
Yeah. Yeah, or, to see a musician that they already care about. What would that mean for them and their experience of music? Something that I struggle with as someone who comes through the conservatory system. You know, I do see a lot of great beauty in these musics that are continuing to be elevated. And a lot of these questions aren't about lowering the value of those pieces, right, and of those art forms, but rather to step back and give space for a recognition of all the other great work and fascinating work and powerful work that's being done beyond this narrow scope that's gotten so much attention.
Yeah.
Yeah. Themes like systemic racism, they're present in all facets of culture. Do you see a specific opportunity or relationship to music as a place to have these conversations or a medium to confront or recognize these issues?
You know, in a lot of ways, these conversations could happen anywhere. But I think because music is such a social practice and it's rooted in, I mean, it's so deeply contextual. Mm. I think that there are opportunities in music. And I think one of the other things that perhaps music does is work on race, and racism often feels deeply personal because it is deeply personal. Mm-hmm. And when we do it in music, it gives us the ability to like look at this practice that is happening off our bodies sometimes. Mm. And perhaps it makes it easier in some ways to have a conversation when, you know, we're talking about race and racism, which is on our bodies. Mm-hmm. Music perhaps gives us a vehicle to take it a tiny step away, even though that isn't, you know, particularly real, just to be able to have a conversation about a practice. Mm-hmm. Perhaps that provides a vehicle that other subjects don't particularly, but mm-hmm. I mean, I think there are clear ways to have conversations across educational contexts, and that's something we should be invested in, given the United States at the moment and
The rest of the world. I mean,
it's pervasive. Like,
yeah,
the
yeah.
way that white supremacy is operating is terrifying.
Yeah. What are your plans now? Have you continued this project of working on racism and whiteness within music education? Is that still your focus?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to remain a focus. I wished that I could think of a time where it won't be necessary, but I don't think it's in the immediate future.
Yeah.
I've got a book coming out in June on constructing an activist music education in K-12 schooling. Mm. So thinking about what it might mean, you know, to give youth a space to really think about their own expressive potential, ways to connect, and also, you know, how do we create a practice of noticing in school? Like, how do we bring that same critical eye and develop that critical eye mm-hmm. among the youth we teach as well, so that their analysis is on point mm-hmm. and that they are critical of what the ideologies that shape what they encounter. So that project is really informed by a group of 20 activist musicians who I was in conversation with about what they might have liked to have had given what they do now and with their music in the world, what might have set them up in schools to do their thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now I'm continuing to work on critical race work. I'm just working on a project now about the way we use storytelling and social justice work in ways that are, you know, frankly problematic, and reinscribe some of the same dynamics that we're trying to avoid. Mm. And part of my work is turning a critical eye on social justice work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ethan, do you have any last questions for Juliet?
No, I'm just really excited for the book.
Oh, thank you. Me too. I'm excited for it to exist in the world so I can also continue to work on other things.
Yeah.
It was an exciting project. I really enjoyed working on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Juliet, do you have any last comments on these themes you want to share?
No, but I really appreciate just being in conversation with both of you.
Yeah, this has been a really lovely conversation. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your insight and your work.
Absolutely. And thanks for having me.
All right. Wow. That was some great content. Lots of important ideas in that conversation. Ethan, thank you for giving us a reason to invite Dr. Juliet Hess on. That was really great. So this is now my time to put you on the spot. Given all this conversation and your familiarity with obviously the paper itself, can you give a summary of this project, of this work on music education and whiteness and naming whiteness and all of that?
Yeah, I mean, so what Juliet is doing is diagnosing a problem, which is that the persistence of white supremacist ideology in music education, first of all, exists, and second, is largely unacknowledged by the practitioners, and certainly rarely addressed when music educators themselves are learning. And Juliet then proposes a series of solutions using the examples of four educators who are doing the work, who are naming the issues, even working with fairly young children, and doing it in a positive, constructive, and not, you know, accusatory way, mm-hmm. with the hope that, you know, other people might read this and say, oh, this is a thing I can do without anyone getting upset and without my getting fired.
Mm-hmm. Without my getting fired. Yep. That, yes. I appreciate how she takes these experiences from these specific contexts of music appreciation classes and then talks about how these implications reverberate through all of these different levels of music education, including post-secondary education. So was there anything that surprised you in our discussion about where this work comes from and what it means?
I don't know if it's a surprise, but people should know who Juliet is in doing this work. She is somebody who came through the classical pipeline. Mm-hmm. She is somebody who is speaking to these issues very much from the inside, mm-hmm. which is refreshing and fairly unusual. Most of the vocal critics of the, you know, naivete and whiteness of music education are coming from jazz and from, you know, pop music educators and from people outside of the music academy. I mean, some of the most prominent hip-hop scholars are people from English departments or sociology of education departments. And it takes a lot of courage for somebody who has attained the status that Juliet has to be willing to critique this home that she's found for herself. Mm-hmm. I really admire it.
And this is a conversation that people in these positions need to be having, because we are mostly responsible for it. So it's up to us to address and change and listen in order to learn and change. And sometimes voices like Juliet are a lot easier to listen to than those of people that come from outside of our institutions. It sounds like there's a lot of different ways in which this work touches on your own approach and your own projects to music education.
Oh, sure. Like Juliet, I'm very interested in trying to sort of turn the aircraft carrier of the university, because there certainly are a lot of progressive-minded music educators out there. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who have good intentions, but like Juliet said, if you want to attain musical competencies and cultural competencies beyond the sort of Western canonical core, mm-hmm. you got to do it in free time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that asks a lot of people, and there are people who are doing it, but you know, we can't expect everyone to be superhuman.
Yeah.
You know, so the hope is that, you know, if we can turn the aircraft carrier of the university, that it'll have long-lasting downstream effects yeah. in the field.
Yeah. And for those of us sort of adjacent to the field. Yeah.
This is a conversation that is coming whether the field wants to have it or not. Mm-hmm. If only just for demographic reasons. So an yeah. overwhelming majority of music educators are white and of relatively high socioeconomic status. I'm not sure exactly when it's going to happen, but pretty soon in the United States, white students are going to be a minority in the public school population. Mm-hmm. And like New York City, that happened many, many years ago. Mm-hmm. So as white educators are working with increasingly non-white populations, you know, these issues are not going to be optional. Mm-hmm. And so it would be good to kind of get out in front of them at the post-secondary education level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate having access to this conversation, which I feel is not entirely missing from other areas of music academia. There certainly are people working on not only different cultures, but more conscientious engagement with musical cultures and musical practices outside of the Eurocentric canon. But in order for that work to also be fully recognized and integrated in our understanding of what music is, we have to be having these conversations throughout the entire research community as well. So thank you so much for bringing this article to our attention and for sharing your perspective on it as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is a treat.
And that's it for this episode of the So Strangely podcast on recent research in music science. If you like what you heard and you want to support the podcast, please consider reviewing it on iTunes or wherever you listen and share your favorite episodes on social media. And if you want to get in touch, you can find us on Twitter, So Strangely Pod. You can find us on Facebook as the So Strangely Podcast. And obviously our website, sostrangely.com, has all of the relevant information. And there too, you can find a contact link where if you're a music academic and you have your hands on a new publication that you think people should hear about in the music science community, you can drop a line and let me know whether, you know, about a specific work and whether you'd like to be on as well to talk about another piece of important work for us all to engage with. So thank you for listening. And until next time, keep digging into how and why music sometimes behaves so strangely.
Sometimes behaves so strangely. Sometimes behaves so strangely. So strangely. So strangely, so strangely, so strangely.